Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June 28th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening, the forum is titled, The Ordination of Gay and Lesbian Pastors. Should the church keep the door half open? The tape number is FO200104. Let's listen in.
I'm Jan Bowman, and I'm going to serve as moderator of this evening's panel and forum. And I'm delighted to do that, even though I was somewhat arm-twisted into this at a teaching faculty meeting earlier this week. This is Gay Awareness, Gay Pride Week. We began with a parade on Sunday. It was just a terrific parade in a semi-downpour. And we've continued throughout the week. And if you were here on Tuesday night, you saw the video of the ordination service of Anita Hill at St. Paul Reformation Church. Did I say that right, Roger? Okay. In a film that was recently made by Pam Walton called Call to Witness, Pam Walton is a filmmaker, and she was commissioned by a group to make that. It's about gay and lesbian Lutherans' attempts to become pastors. Pam says that the film exposes all the hypocritical baloney about how church officials want to enter into a dialogue and come to a deeper understanding. And speaking of ELCA leaders, she continues, they're a fairly progressive bunch, but they're just using dialogue as a stall tactic. Now, at Holden, we don't usually have stall tactics. Holden is a place where we let a lot of things that have been stalled, we just move them on in the spirit of being a people with vision, a people who live by the call of the gospel to be aware and courageous and to live out our faith. So it's in that spirit that we're holding this forum tonight. At the same time, we don't want you to feel in any sense that a particular view is being promoted that you must hold. We invite all opinions, all ideas, all insights at this forum. So let me begin by introducing our panelists. Our first speaker will be Roy Satry, who has served as a pastor in small town and open country churches from 1962 to 1988. And he's been an assistant to the bishop in southeastern, he's been the assistant to the bishop in southeastern Minnesota in that synod since January of 1988. He and his wife Dorothy retire, oh my goodness, this September 1st.
Certainly.
Next, our next speaker will be Roger Bush, who is a volunteer at Holden doing computer support from July 15th of 2000 until August of 2002. And Roger says, I'm the oldest male long-term staff member in the village. He graduated from the University of Iowa in 1968, and he spent 2 years as an officer in the U.S. Army. He practiced dentistry for 15 years in rural Iowa, and he has worked for 15 years as a computer programmer. A member of St. Paul Reformation Lutheran Church for some time, and he has been out as a gay since, as a gay member of that church since 1970. Next is Karen Herseth Wee, who is a poet living in Northfield, Minnesota. She will be speaking from the perspective of the mother of a lesbian daughter and an active member, along with her husband, David Wee, of PFLAG, Parents and Friends of Lesbian and Gay People. And next is Dan Gesslin, who grew up in a Lutheran family in Minnesota and attended St. Olaf College and the Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary. An ordained minister at the United Church of Christ for the past 20 years, Dan started the AIDS chaplaincy program at San Francisco General Hospital and has served as founding pastor of two primarily gay-lesbian congregations in the UCC, Spirit of the Lakes, UCC in Minneapolis, and Liberation UCC in Cleveland, Ohio. Here with his partner, John Savage, the village fire chief, Dan is spending a year at Holden, in part to take a rest from working on gay-lesbian issues. The whole concept of relaxing at Holden. And finally, we have Sue Roberts, who is a health sex educator and an AIDS educator for the School District in Reno, Nevada, and is currently teaching 4th, 5th, and 6th grade classes. But she has taught other age groups as well, she told me. So we're just very pleased to have this group of people with us. And they're going to speak for about five minutes each. I'm going to be the timekeeper. And then we will open it up for discussion. So keep the questions flowing, you know. Jot them down if you have paper or remember what they are so that you can ask a question. And you may direct your questions to a particular speaker. That's why I wrote their names on the board, or to the panel in general. So, Roy, would you begin, please?
Okay. Well, it was in the second or third week of June, 12 years ago, when Dorothy and I and Sarah and her partner, Irene, were seated in this room. And that was my and our first coming out publicly, and we're all four here together. I think this is most interesting tonight, because 12 years ago, there wasn't room for one more person in the balcony, nor in this room. This place was packed. I think that's progress. I think that's an understanding. I think people are more relaxed about this today than 12 years ago. I'm more relaxed tonight than 12 years ago. I could hardly speak. But it was important because I knew that I had to come out as a father of Sarah, a lesbian. And I also knew that this was a safe place to speak and to come out. For a long time, our daughter Sarah was not a practicing Christian in a congregation. And recently, over the last 3 or 4 years, through the prayers and conversation of a pastor who happens to be in this room, and I think it was in that order, prayers and conversation, she is now worshiping in a congregation. She is assisting in that liturgy occasionally, and she is on the call committee of that congregation, who will soon call another pastor. Dorothy and I wanted to continue to tell our story. So over the last 10 or 12 years, we have spoken to several dozen adult groups and teenage groups within our synod, southeastern Minnesota, and beyond. And all of that is good and proper for us to do, for ourselves, but especially for the witness to the church and to other people. When it comes to ordination or consecration of a the ordination of a pastor in the ELCA. I'm talking now of rostered people in the ELCA. You're ordained as a pastor, you're consecrated as a diaconal minister, and you are commissioned as an associate in ministry. Ordination takes place by the church, for the church, by the whole church, for the whole church. There is always a, and there always has been, a process to ordain or commission or consecrate people. But it is always by the whole church, for the whole church, that that takes place. Letter from the Bishop of California was read at Vespers, I think the letter said that celibate gay or lesbian people who are serving in the church would not be able to serve in the church. They would not receive another call or appointment. I hope I'm quoting that correctly. I think that's what I've heard. That is not true, because I've had gay and lesbian pastors who are celibate who have talked with me, and they've talked with my bishop, and of course they will receive another call. Of course they will. A radical way for this to change would be for a bishop to ahead of time decide that she or he was going to be a short-term bishop and to ordain gay or lesbian people who are in a committed relationship, to ordain or consecrate or commission them. And then the bishop would have a short term. Because a bishop is installed by the church for the church. And that means that a bishop lives under, goes by the policies of the church, which at the present time say that an ordained person must be celibate, an ordained, commissioned, consecrated person serving in the church must be celibate, and if not, the person will have to leave the roster. Well, if a bishop was going to do that, ordain a person called by a congregation and who was in a committed relationship, if a bishop went ahead and did that, then the bishop would be out of a job. I think I'll stop there.
All right. Thank you, Roy. Roger, would you pick up from there, okay, please?
Our summer theme is centered on the text of Isaiah of being called by name. The question I'm being faced with is, does God call a gay man by name? I would identify with being saved on March 18, 1958, an act by God which cannot be undone. This was before I became a member of the Lutheran Church and had not understood my gay identity. It was my struggle with my orientation that brought me to the Lutheran Church. My spiritual journey has included many visions, which have included seeing Holden Village 8 years ago, even though I didn't know about it until April of 2000. A year ago, I survived an auto accident on the freeway in Minneapolis, where I was broadsided in heavy traffic 2 days after my acceptance to Holden. I walked away with only minor injuries. My sense about being here is one of being placed, not one of conscious choice. My strongest vision is of Christ in a ravine, surrounded by large crowds begging to touch him and to be healed. His face shows great sorrow and pain, and he is shedding a river of tears. He looks at me and asks, "Why have they not done what I have asked them to do?" I ask myself, why does Christ ask me this question? What can I do to make a difference? Holden has helped me to understand Christ's message of a loving God and loving your neighbor. The God and Christ's love of the outcast and the outsider is the message that the church needs to hear. Does God call a gay or a lesbian to minister? I feel that God has called me to help those who come to Holden to open their hearts and to end the continued crucifixion of Christ by the church. I feel the healing tears of Jesus each time I experience prayer around the cross.
Karen will speak next. I'm Karen Griseth Wee, and I'm in the village for a couple of weeks along with my husband and my daughter, Rebecca, and with my sister in Christ and in heart, Kristen Wee, and her husband, Daniel. And our family has been much influenced by this village. The only authority by which I'm in your presence tonight is that I happen to be the mother of a lesbian daughter. I didn't know that for a lot of years. Neither did she. But the educational journey we were on has brought us to this place, and it is a place of celebration, even in the midst of all the pain. For a while, we had to learn in 10-league boots, as the fairy story says. And I see our small family as a microcosm of many families who, through searching and in pain, come to be reconciled and redeemed, both in their journey of knowledge and in their relationship to their God. It isn't an easy journey. But our small family is a good metaphor for the large family of the church. I don't mean just the Lutheran church. I mean the church, where we are all of one family. We are all welcome. I struggle with the arbitrariness of churches who can decide who is a more legitimate member than another. Our daughter, Allison, as well as Rebecca and Jonathan, were raised as much by our church in Northfield as by David and me. And when Allison stood and was confirmed and the church stood beside her and said, "We will support her in her spiritual journey," my question to them now is, are you going to sit down? Part of her spiritual journey is learning that she was becoming a lesbian from the time she was in my womb. And so I think I'll read to you a few poems that will let you see inside my heart deeper than I can say when I'm just talking to you. I was observing this daughter in our family, as well as our other children, when they were small. And most of these poems that I will read to you, there are only two or three of them. Only the last one is written after I knew. This one is written when she was very small. "You arrived running, all bone and sinew, and on every photo after one sock wrinkles down. Later, word comes from Lesbos that you are here only for a visit. I had thought you mine, that I could own you in my image. But you insist and show me that wonderful mind of your own, revealing the rib-locked secret, your becoming self, coming fast before my very heart." Next one is called "How to Say." "I don't know how to say this. You are not what I expected. Your father and I came together at a particular moment in our knowing, and from deep inside me, you already were, made in the image of the great God who loves you even more than I do, and that's saying something. made in my image too, of course, and your father's, those young years when you looked like him, the tomboy ones when you walked like me. And now, woman, on course among careless teachings and wrong-headed ones, you make your way, all the while reaching a hand back to me. I will keep up, but I'm not as young as you, nor as urgent, but I am coming, dear heart. I am coming. Do not get out of sight, and I will bring others. The poetry reading. She comes late, sits at my feet before the 10 readers in our audience. She's come to hear our instruments of words, cadences, truth hanging in the air. Her hand on my boot is warm. She leans this daughter heat into my thigh, a summer child sprung from my forehead like Athena from Zeus, her baseball cap already on backwards. She sees differently fundamental things like music, math, love, and possibility, the uncharted routes of escape. And I didn't know it, but I had a poem about the summer Holden theme. A tall girl in large glasses perches immobile on a log near a creek, her rounded shoulders hunch against a nameless future. Her lips move, but she makes no sound. Her shadow steals away in the twilight. Nearby, a small wary weasel stares at her from beneath the roots of a fallen elm. Its head is white against winter, body still soft brown. It watches the girl while the creek flows. Light fades. Neither move. When the snows come, it will have a new name. She wonders, between the brown time and the white time, does an ermine ever not know how to be, even when it's with its friends? Will she ever know the safety of a new season and a new name? The last one is called Coming Out. And Rebecca commented the other day, she sometimes writes with a piece of paper in the middle of the car as she's driving. And that's how this one came. I was leaving work at St. Olaf, and it was fall, and there were apple trees blooming, these ornamental crabs that you see, and I was driving home, and it was just amazing. We'd had an early frost, and I thought, in the springtime, and it had set them all back, and all of a sudden, the blooms were in the fall. So this is called Coming Out. All over town, crabapple trees have come out, blooming in the wrong season, the wrong climate. People have noticed, yet no one can account for it. So some have begun to consult the specialists. Others hold that an early frost last spring set the trees on a different course. But in any event, it is nature, true nature at her surprisingest. The way I see it, the only thing to do is sit back, enjoy, or get out of the way of their blooming in our front yards, along the roadways, and in the distance. But I urge you, stop long enough to attend closely to their beauty, the fragileness of flower. Study the blooms, those tight buds, the leaves coming out all around us when most other Midwestern trees turn gray. I guess I wish, and I will quote David Nasby, who is president of the congregation at Central Church in Minneapolis. My great hope for the church is that we would be a headlight and not a taillight in this issue.
Thank you, Karen. Dan?
I've spoken in different meetings this all week, and I think I'd like to. I'll keep my comments brief so we can move into a general discussion. But as a Lutheran who grew up Lutheran and was educated Lutheran, and got and visited my bishop and was presented with that question of celibacy, and I said no. God created
creation and said it is good. And I am part of that goodness. And God loves me just as I am. And I have to leave you Lutherans. And that was the hardest thing for me to do. And it took a year. And then I found the United Church of Christ, who opened their arms and enthusiastically brought me in as a full member and ordained me. And I wonder why there's the difference. And so just really briefly, I'd like to tell you about the United Church of Christ, also known as the Congregationalist Church, because it vests all power and authority in the congregation and not in bishops. This is the tradition of the Pilgrims and Plymouth Rock and the Mayflower. When they left England, a persecuted little group, their pastor on the Mayflower, John Robinson, gave a sermon that's called the Farewell to Europe sermon. And in it he said a sentence that we still affirm in the United Church of Christ as our relationship with Scripture. He said, "There is ever yet new light and truth to break forth from God's holy word. There is ever yet new light and truth to break forth from God's holy word." So unlike many denominations who look to the Bible as something to preserve the past, in the United Church of Christ, we have always had a tradition of looking to Scripture in a prophetic way to see where God is leading us in the future. And in 1776, 70% of the colonists were Congregationalists who were putting on the Boston Tea Party and preaching revolution from their pulpits. And when that Revolutionary War ended in 1783, the Congregationalists ordained the first African-American in U.S. history, whose name was Lemuel Haynes. They worked in New England. The Congregationalists worked in partnership with the Quakers of Pennsylvania to set up the Underground Railroad, worked hard for the emancipation of slavery, and it was predominantly the church ladies who both started the Sunday school movement and worked for the emancipation of slaves. And once the Civil War was finished, turned their efforts to the emancipation of women. And whereas the Lutheran Church started ordaining women, I believe it's 76?
70.
The Congregationalists started ordaining women in 1856. That first generation of women is who were ordained, are the group of women we often refer to as the first wave of feminism. Famous names like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony worked within the Congregational Church. After the Civil War, Congregationalists went into the South and started 500 schools called Freedmen Schools for the slaves. And today, the United Church of Christ is the most integrated denomination in the country. And in the South, if you go to the First Congregational Church of, say, Selma, Alabama, that will be a UCC congregation. Because of that, in the 60s, the UCC was in the forefront of the civil rights movement. And in 1969, 2 months before the famous Stonewall Revolt, the United Church of Christ in Assembly voted to support civil rights for gay and lesbian people. 3 years later, in 1972, the General Synod, which is democratically elected from local congregations, passed a resolution calling for the ordination of openly gay and lesbian people in 72. So milieu that I work in, this is no longer an issue. And yet the church continues to function. And I just wanted to lift that up as an alternative. Not that you should go join the UCC. but that there are other paths and to give you hope in the ELCA for continuing to move hopefully toward greater inclusion.
Thank you, Dan. Sue. I'm not sure why I'm on this panel. I'm a United Methodist laywoman, and so I'm not able to shed any light at all. I've learned a lot this week, though, about the Lutheran ordination process. But we're facing some of the very same struggles. It takes a little different form because we ordain differently. It's just at the step above the local church level, so that we have annual conferences, which are probably similar to a synod. And ordination takes place in that venue. But it's the whole issue has become very, as you probably know, very divisive one in our communion as well, so much so that people think that United Methodist is not oxymoron. Neither United nor Methodist in some people's eyes. And the notoriety that we've gotten has been more in the issue of the blessing of Holy Union's commitment services. Where that does take place at the local church level, and it's not the whole church that puts itself at risk, but the pastor, who risks the charges. Well, that wasn't why I was asked to be here. As a sex educator, I'm here in I'm a biological resource person, and I can't say that I can shed much more light from that viewpoint either. I certainly have had a lot of training, workshops, seminars, reading, and so forth in the roots and causes of homosexuality. And what I've learned is that there's no agreement. And that there is, when I was starting out, my background, in addition to being health educators and child development, and I remember being told in no uncertain terms that homosexuality was caused, it was sort of like a case of arrested development. It was sort of a failure of someone to negotiate one of the tasks that one's supposed to do in adolescence. They were supposed to deal with identity and authority and independence and sexuality. And and so it was kind of a, like I said, a failure to get through that rite of passage and go on to a mature place. Well, we've come a long way since then, but we haven't, certainly with the unraveling of the human genome, we haven't discovered a gay gene. There are a lot of different factors that have been considered and that people firmly believe contribute. They may be genetic, hormonal, psychological, family systems, all kinds of things that have been put forth. And the probably this is a very complex issue. We won't come up with a single, you know, I'm not going to find a gene on chromosome 17 or something that's going to explain everything. But I'd just like to ask, what if we did? What difference would that make? How would we handle that? What would we do with it? I think we'll stop there.
All right. Now we are ready to take your questions and comments. And I will try to see everyone in the room, but that's a little difficult. So you may need to call out, and I'll ask for other members of the panel to help me with that. Who would like to begin? Who has a question? Yes.
We were here a number of years ago, and there was a young man named Michael. Somebody, does anybody remember him? Tall, handsome guy.
I think it was Dan.
Dan. Okay, he's got a tape in there someplace. Mm-hmm. He went through the scriptures and very methodically, and had a totally different interpretation than the way they're used to bang D and lesbians over the head. You know, which was very revealing to me. I mean, it's can't use Leviticus the way that the other side uses Leviticus once you read the rest of it and everything,
right.
You know, and Corinthians and right down the line, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, did you guys cover some of that while I was even getting in there?
We already solved that problem.
So yeah. But what you're saying is that he said it in the social, cultural, historical context, so that you could see that the interpretation needed to be a little more intricate. That you know, just taking one verse out of context and
Well, some of them, he turned them around 180 degrees for me, you know, which is very helpful. Not that I've ever thought the Bible was let down from heaven on a string. You know, I never believed that.
No, you didn't.
No. Well, maybe. When I went through Luther confirmation, one pastor kind of wanted us to think that about something. Anyway, is that not going to be covered tonight?
Well, we could certainly get into that. But the question that we put before us tonight is on the board. The ordination of gay and lesbian pastors. Should the church keep the door half open? Now, that's a...
Well, if they're using the scriptures to keep it closed, then then it's pertinent, but maybe you don't want to...
It certainly is pertinent, I think what we're trying to do tonight is to respond to this recent ordination service that is not being recognized by ELCA officials. Other questions or responses? Yes.
I'm curious, and I'll address this to Roy, because he has a position within the church, and the hierarchy of the Lutheran Church. My opinion, being a Lutheran for most of my life, is that ELC has been pretty progressive on issues. And they don't seem to be taking a leadership position on this. And I guess my question is this, and it's a tough one, and probably don't, there's no answer to it, but is this a tough one for them to come up theologically and say it's right, or are they fearful of a strong minority, majority, whatever, among the congregations? Because it doesn't, with the history of the way that I've seen over the years, progressive, this, they stalled. Is this fear, or is it in their heart they would like to see it happen, but they can't because they see a bunch of people out there that might not go along with them, and they're not willing to take a stand?
The Lutheran Church is similar to a glacier. It moves slowly. And I really do believe that we have made progress. I don't want that to be a light word. I think some progress and understanding has taken place just sticking with the ELCA, which went into operation in January of 1988, and certainly there's a prior history of Lutheran Church bodies behind that. It really has been a hard thing for the Evangelical Lutheran Church to move with this. I think that when the decision is made to ordain pastors who are in a committed relationship publicly, but not just pastors, associates in ministry, diaconal ministers. I don't know how that will be received by the congregations across the country. I think it's a good educated guess that there will be a split. I don't know what that means and how that will take place. There will be a lot of people joining the church, and there will be a lot of people leaving the church. The vision and the mission of the church will be shaped in a new way when that takes place.
Is that true when women were first starting in the church? Because I'm not always pretty happy about it.
Probably.
Well, yeah, I expect not as strident. It's just a guess on my part. I don't know.
Yeah. If I were to walk into the bishop's office with my two daughters. Yeah. Both of whom wish to be Lutheran pastors.
Yeah.
And one of them is straight and the other is lesbian.
Yeah.
What would be the way in which the bishop's office, the leaders of the church, would say to convince us as a family that this one can be a pastor and that one cannot?
Yeah.
It's that visions and frustrations statement that's in the vision. What is it?
Expectations.
I think visions and frustrations. But it's that statement that hangs up people, because no one wants to focus on the sexuality of the persons involved. I mean, that's what's behind that statement, is practicing gay members. I don't know if many of us go around trying to envision what happens with heterosexuals as they practice, but that's what makes everyone so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And maybe everyone just needs more practice. Humor to be in this topic, but I also have to confess I'm really impatient with forums and discussions. While we talk, lives are being led and decisions are being made about whether one can or cannot go into ministry. In the case of our daughter, she spent 10 years working in a coffee shop after college, some of which time was because she after college and probably would have been out and been a minister by now. Now, if she were here, she may argue that because she has changed paths. And she's in an educational program. She's working on a PhD at the University of Minnesota, and she's very happy doing that, and I think she'll be a great teacher. But I think it's a real loss for the church. It's a loss for our family because we happen to be a family of pastors. Her grandfather was, and she honored and respected that. She's got uncles and aunts who are and wanted to follow in their footsteps. And any of you who are proud when your children follow in your footsteps would know what that would feel like. So I have a great impatience about it. Yes?
Well, I share your impatience. And the only comment that I wanted to make is that I'm aware of a church in the Minneapolis area, and I won't mention it because there's a name that's attached to it, that, and I heard this secondhand, where the pastor said at least 6 or 7 years ago, got up and said in the pulpit, gay and lesbian people are going to be welcomed people in this congregation. They're going to be a part of this congregation from this point on. End of conversation. Mm-hmm. I think, as it was told to me, one or two families left. But that was it. I mean, I yearn for the day, I think at this point, that the bishop would say, from this point on, gay and lesbian people will be permitted to be ordained in the full ministry of word and sacrament in the ELCA. I mean, that's my impatience. So let's get on with it. Because I fear the forums, not the forums, but the debate and the conflict and all of that going on and on. And I realize the polity of the ELCA is not such that the bishop can say, this is it. We all are welcome within this church and welcome.
That's what happens with the conversations in the churches hoping to become reconciled in Christ,
right?
Kinds of that's the name for Lutheran churches that say out loud they are welcome. But they always have to do it through this argumentative way, and the pastors are quite timid and afraid people will leave. They think a lot about the fact that there are a few of us leaving on the other side of it,
right.
And also beginning to withhold money. I think money is money talks in our culture, and those of us who care about this as a justice issue ought to start giving our money not to the churches who allow us to be comfortable in our prejudice, but to churches working for justice and organizations that are.
Just recently, in an adult Christian ethics series at our church, we had a Dr. Fredrickson from seminary, and he gave some earth-shaking results of interpreting some of these proof texts that we use to justify our looking at, and talking about Paul, and what I got out of that was that we're way off course on how this is interpreted. He brings out that back then, sex was a singular thing. You know, it was almost self-gratification. That's the only thing that was. There wasn't any partnership carrying one to the other, and it really all people or some people were saying, why weren't we told this before? And he's probably a radical. I have many people say so, but he really shed some light on things. I don't know how people can call this sin, you know, if that's a hang-up. But I've said it so many times that I think people hung up on a plumbing issue, and that's the whole thing, you know. And then they use the Bible to justify their feelings.
I agree with that. In using the term proof texting, you know, we have our positions and then we look for a text to justify it. But I want to turn the tables and, as a panel member, ask the audience this question that has come up before this week in other ways, which is, I'm gay, I don't understand you, heterosexuals. What is the fear? What, not what's the Bible theology, but underneath that, what is your fear? Why is this such a passionate fear in, not even in society, but in the person?
I can only speak as a male, but I would guess, you know, I think that 40-year-old males are the most spooked, because, you know, it must be some kind of insult against their masculinity. I don't know, but...
Yeah. Well, I think some think, I've heard people talk, I've been on a study on this stuff too, and I think some people are afraid that you'll teach their children, and because they feel it's a sin. But I just think, well, who is the sinner here? You know, I'm a sinner too, and I certainly wouldn't want to judge you as a sinner. And I work with people out east. I started an emergency program for people with AIDS, and they were mostly gay and lesbian people. And I always knew that God loved everybody, but I know now God loves everybody because they really had a struggle. Nobody would have anything to do with them. They were on the streets. And I know God loves them, and if they feel that they have a call, if God has called them to be a pastor, who are we to say that they can't be one?
I think there's a great fear of, in conversations that I've had in our local ministerium, and whenever this has been a forum type thing and for lack of a better word, I think there's a great fear of a domino sexuality effect, to be very truthful, and even some people have brought materials from groups like Lutherans Concerned as almost their proof texts. That, okay, I can, someone might say I can understand and even bless, you know, if a gay person is gay and they're a committed relationship, let the church bless that, let the church even bless and ordain a person into this. But now here come materials that say Lutherans Concerned supporting gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual, and then, you know, there's this fear of a domino. A theory that, and especially in our sex-obsessed culture, we open the door from halfway to all the way open, and, you know, will the church ordain people who just whatever expression of sexual self-pleasure that they get pleasure in? Well, but if God loves them, if that's the way they find pleasure in their sexuality, I really think that's a legitimate concern out there, is that sort of domino thing. You know.
Something both Karen and Dan said, I get lots of feedback from parents children to take sex education. We, by the way, have the most comprehensive program in the state of Nevada. But man, we avoid homosexuality like it's a poisonous topic, because we barely even use the words. We have to. We're doing AIDS education, and so we, you know, there are a few things we have to say, but we get this feeling, especially from church people, that there's a great fear of just sexuality in general. It's ironic what you said about the sex-saturated culture. We have this huge fear of almost anything to do with genuinely looking at our sexual nature. And the more I suppose ever since, not even the Masters and Johnson, the Indiana people, whose name has escaped me, as part of his
family. Talking about the Kinsey people?
Yes. You know, there have been attempts to look at sexuality, the whole broad spectrum. And the more we look at it, the more we realize, that the more some people are coming to realize that there's a continuum, that there isn't just, you know, straights over here and gays over here, and somehow that the fear that people that I hear expressed is that, lots of them are based on misunderstandings. Like, there's a great fear of that somehow gays are going to recruit kids, that they are pedophiles. And yet, when you look at the numbers, obviously the huge, much greater numbers of pedophiles are in the straight community. But those are the kinds of misunderstandings. The kids think, fourth, fifth, and sixth graders, think gays are boys who want to be girls. That's what they, I don't know where they get the idea. I don't know, but those are the kind of misunderstandings that are out there. So with all these strange things floating around, it's no wonder there's a lot of fear.
You've been waiting over here, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, this idea where you just said, this big fear that starts with little kids, boys that want to be girls, and what a terrible thing that would be. It strikes me that, you're asking what's at risk. Seems to me is a sort of, the fear is what? Emasculation, and that is rooted in misogyny, that we still have, sort of terrible attitudes about the value of women, so therefore any male that, sort of acts like a woman, or any woman that might act like a man, and I'm using those as stupid generalizations, but, where else? I don't know how to figure out where that comes from, but somehow the power will be lost, that if straight white males have had power, and somehow this, I don't know.
Things will fall apart.
Yeah, it's all going to be terrible, isn't it? Perversions of all sorts, and I don't know. I just, that seems one answer to the question.
It seems to me that one of the things church people can agree upon is that in our culture we don't have very healthy attitudes towards sexuality.
Right. Yeah.
And if we would spend half of our energy trying to learn and then teach what those healthy relationships would be, and the Bible would support that. The Bible comes down on exploitation of relationship in almost every context. It just does not come down on right relationship. And
okay, Gary, and then you.
A couple of the fears that I've experienced as a parish pastor. When I invited our congregation to...
Gary, could you speak just a little
bit? It's your pastor voice. They might me. When I invited our parish into conversation and study and prayer around this, I think the first year we lost $150,000 and 25 families. And I think one of the fears in the church and among clergy who tend to be reconcilers and not confronters or prophets is a loss of income. Can we really afford this? And lay people and clergy and bishops have real questions about what will happen to the institution. And that's a fear that isn't talked about a lot, but it's a fear that I've experienced personally,
And people who I've worked with in parishes have experienced and have said, you know, I can't afford that. They determine whether or not I get paid. And my understanding is, I'm a pastor of the church. I may serve a congregation or a particular ministry, but they are not my boss. And I'm very, very clear about that. But that's a real kind of gut fear. And do I get paid? Mm-hmm. So.
Yes. Yes, sir. Okay, Mr. Smith.
Yeah. The question for Dan, why do you think this seemed like an easier transition for the congregational church?
I don't know, but I think someone should write a PhD dissertation.
Well, I took notes on your history, and you know what my conclusion is?
What?
The authority lies within the laity, right? That's how the decisions are made. There's not the same hierarchy.
But that always, that's true. Somehow it works there, but you know, it's like counterintuitive. At least maybe it's my Lutheran background. But I always think of the clergy as being ahead, leading, and it's the people in the pews who are lagging behind. But that's not the model in the UCC, and it hasn't worked that way. So, and there is that theological history. I mean, one of the things, like the way Lutherans talk about grace all the time, which is another irony in this particular issue, but as much, the UCC has this phrase you hear all the time, which is, the gospel is perceived and expressed in social justice. The gospel is perceived and expressed in social justice. So that combined with, there's ever yet new truth to break forth from Scripture, when that becomes your whole orientation, it does seem to have had an effect. And it might be that, I'm just speculating, it might be that the educational norm is higher in the United Church of Christ. I would guess that. There certainly has always been a strong educational emphasis in Lutheranism as well. But I think gay and lesbian people tend to fare better in educated places than in non-educated places. And the UCC leadership did show leadership. And a last point here to make this even bigger is, maybe if we, you know, zoomed back and we're looking at a big picture, we might be in a time of a new Reformation in which the churches are going to reconfigure. You know, what will Christianity look like in the West in the next 100 years from now? And this is sort of a tip of the iceberg issue, but you know, but if the ELCA started ordaining gay and lesbian people, and some of the members moved to the Missouri Church. And some Missourians, well, already there's been Missourians coming into the ELCA, or across Presbyterian, Methodist, UCC lines. What if that those old, there's not much ethnicity left in those in the Reformed churches anymore? And what if Presbyterians and Methodists reconfigure into a progressive church and a conservative church? Is that what's going on? The UCC is very consciously betting that it is, and positioning itself for a new church that unites people leaving the Lutheran Church and the Methodist Church and the Presbyterian Church. This is conscious decision, and they're talking about it as a market niche.
So it is about
about money.
That there's a place that they wanna be out there as a place where liberal Christians can come when they give up.
Okay, so Dan, ask you to stop here for a minute. You've got about five hands in the air, David.
Okay. Very quickly, I think that one of the problems with our sexual hang-ups in the country has to do with the need for power and control in a patriarchal society. And that needs, you know, a lot of unpacking. But I think we would all agree that probably the most widespread perverse and violent use of sexuality in our country is rape of women by heterosexual men. But I have never heard anybody denounce heterosexuals as a class because there is so much sexual violence toward women. But you hear just one instance of somebody seeing a sexual condition amongst the gay and lesbian community, and bingo, the whole class of gays and lesbians is rejected.
Paul?
I hear these arguments, and I sure understand them. I think we all do in this room. I'm going to twist it a little bit. When I graduated from college, I had an English major, and I didn't know anything about African-American literature. So when I went out teaching, I taught the same stuff I'd been taught. Then, through my own study and through graduate school and so on, the whole thing changed for me. The canon changed. And shame on me if I kept teaching what I used to teach. And I'm saying that shame on us if we go back to our congregations and just get our adult heads in order and buy our new chairs for the entryway and hire our musicians and do stuff the same way. If we know and we don't do anything, then it's our fault. We're the church, and we can sit back and keep waiting for the bishops to act. They ain't gonna. We know the fear that's there. We know the hierarchy that's in place. We know the protocol, and we know the policies. We know all that stuff. But so we can sit back and not teach the black lit stuff, and that's my analogy, or we can say, no, it's got to change, and we're going to change the canon. And we can do that, but we can't go back home from Holden now and just take it as always has been. If we do, shame on us.
Mm-hmm. And Paul, I'll make even a little more clear. I think it is the task of the heterosexual community to do this, because we are in the majority, just in numbers, and we cannot expect the GLBT community to do the emotional work of everybody all the time. They have their own lives to lead, and it's hard, and it has to come from the rest of us. And I just can't tell you how important I think that is.
Okay. Yeah, Chris.
I've been observing something that happened in my mom's church, and that was the minister ended up divorcing his wife and wasn't asked to leave. He left voluntarily. But it was really interesting for me to watch the people that were accepting of what had happened and the people just that left. And the people that left were the young, single people, young couples without kids, and young couples with kids. The people that stayed there and supported the church and stayed with the church were the people that you looked around and you'd go, oh yeah, the Johnsons, they have a kid that's been divorced. And the Andersons, they have a kid that's been divorced. And what's really been interesting for me is I'm out in my family church, and it's pretty interesting for me the number of people that go to my mother and say, I need to talk to you because my daughter came out to me. And in fact, my mother went to the Lutheran campus pastor and his wife and talked to them, and it wasn't 10 years later that they came to her and said, you know, we need to talk to you because we, you know, we have our daughter just came out to us. And I think, you know, when you look, it's like the letter said tonight, when you look at the numbers, they're, you know, you just look in this room, those of us that, you know, have a gay or lesbian person within our family, you know, either immediate family or beyond, in our church family, at work, you start looking at it. It's going to happen, but I agree with Paul. It's not going to happen in the small hierarchy of the church because the exposure isn't great enough. But with the congregations, the exposure is 10% multiplied by all the number of people that know one of those within the 10%.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. You
had
a question.
I grew up Lutheran on the Quaker diet for 20 years, and that's something to offer this group. We're a consensus organization, which means anybody involved with the Friends gets really good at listening to a sense of a meeting and such. This group is no longer deciding whether or not it is okay to ordain gays and lesbians. This particular group has decided that this particular group is completely clear. At this point, all there is to do is to figure out what to do about it. And from that point of view, you know, the possibilities are endless. You've got a congregation in St. Paul now that may end up not being part of the Lutheran Church. They will need to be financially supported. You have got reconciling congregations who are, you are saying, you're worried about losing money. That's where your donations go. You have got congregations that are willing to recognize gay relationships and congregations that are filled. Straight people get married and the ones that are willing to recognize gay relationships. This group is ready to move. We are not the people to ask ourselves why people are homophobic. That isn't this group. This is the group that's ready to just take the individual actions. The hierarchy will follow.
I think you've just commissioned us.
I guess I kind of wanted to add to that. As a younger generational lesbian, I've known about Holden for years, and I've come here very specifically because I knew it was a liberal community, and I knew that it wouldn't be particularly an issue for me to come here, and that I wouldn't have to deal with, like, me and my sexuality and my spirituality, and, you know, that I could just come here, and I found that in the past weeks of being here to be the case, and it's a comfortable and wonderful community. And if I think about, you know, I've been living in a small town in New Mexico for a few years, and I love it. It's my home. But I'll tell you that most of my friends and my generation, and, you know, not just people in their 20s, but people in their 30s who are, it's, you know, the church is like, is so far removed from that community. I feel like I have, you know, this community, and I grew up in a wonderful Lutheran background that gave me a huge amount, and I give a lot to that. But I feel like my community, in terms of my peers, whether they're, you know, gay or lesbian or straight, are often very distanced from what I feel my Christian community is. And I feel like almost as a call to the youth, who everybody talks about all the time as not being a part of church. Like, where are the youth, you know? Well, I'm here at Holden, but when I think about pretty much going out to the country, like, I get really scared. I get really scared of, like, this is it. This is the community. If this room doesn't go back to their churches and start changing things, and hopefully not just in San Francisco and New York, and, you know, like, hopefully in, like, small towns in Nevada and New Mexico and Idaho, and, you know, like, small towns like that that have good thinking people and have gays and lesbians, like, I do sense that. And I also, I mean, I know that I have a role to play in this as well, but I appreciate a lot of what people are saying, and also just say, like, wow, what an amazing thing that people in this room carry right now. And how can you take that out to call not only, you know, gay and lesbian people that you might know, but, like, youth that feel very estranged from the church and feel very estranged from something that they might have been raised in, and are often looking for something, but they're not looking to the church. No, they're not. So, thank you.
Any other comments? Well, I think we're coming to a close here, and it's a very positive note. Rob, why don't you...
I just wanted to say, I think it's been implied, but it hasn't been mentioned so much, is that we're talking a lot more about the church making a statement about ordaining gays and lesbians. We're talking about the church whether or not it has lost people and isn't attracting kids, still teaches people what's right and wrong. Mm-hmm. And if the church says that gays and lesbians aren't okay to be pastors, they're saying it's wrong, mm-hmm. and it's okay to call them names, mm-hmm. and it's okay to shame them into suicide, and so on and so forth. It's much more than ordaining gay and lesbian
right.
pastors.
That's right. Yeah. And we've had, as you know, Holden has had many different kinds of sessions and forums on this subject. I remember one last summer that really involved me, you know. My mind and spirit were fully involved because it was at my level where I can operate. And it was led by Jake, and most of you know Jake. Mm-hmm. And Sarah was there. And it was on the subject of how can each of our churches make that church a welcoming place for gay and lesbian people, fully, you know. And it was both wonderful and painful, that session. Are there any other final... Yes, Rod?
Our pastor buried a gay man. This has been a couple of years ago, whose home church pastor refused to even bury him. Mm-hmm. Now, when we have pastors, if you were in that congregation and you don't have to have a gay issue, how comfortable are you going to that pastor, mm-hmm. regardless of what your issue is? And how do we educate our pastors to be more affirming, mm-hmm. and it was a horrible statement, mm-hmm. and that poor family, mm-hmm. I mean, it just destroyed them, mm-hmm. that we need to try to work with our pastors to become more affirming too.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, thank you all for coming. I would simply like to thank each of the panelists. It's not always easy to do this, and especially to do it time after time. Thank you so much for being with us. And remember that you're all commissioned now.